This is Radio Boston. I'm Jamie Bologna. The Massachusetts millionaires' tax is going to the ballot. After years of political fighting and court battles, both chambers of the Massachusetts legislature gathered on Beacon Hill this afternoon and approved amending the Constitution to raise taxes on the Commonwealth's highest earners. Now, that means the so-called Fair Share Amendment will be put on the ballot in 2022, where voters will ultimately decide its fate. WBUR's Steve Brown was there today and joins us from our Statehouse Bureau. Steve, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Jamie.
So bring us on to the House floor. This is a drama that's been playing out for years. What was the moment of the final vote like?
Yeah, sure. It was anticlimactic and unsurprising. Remember, the State House is still closed because of COVID. So the cheering supporters who were in the gallery 2 years ago when this passed, they were not here today. So it was very quiet and antiseptic. Most everyone knew the outcome of this going in. The final vote was 159 to 41. Support for the amendment actually grew by 12 votes from 2 years ago. The final vote back then was 147 to 48.
So you said quiet and antiseptic, sort of how all things are these days, I guess. What are we hearing from supporters?
Yeah, they are pleased, as you might expect. The Raise Up Coalition, that's the group that backed this amendment, they put out a statement praising the final vote. The statement says that the amendment provides sustainable long-term revenue for investments in transportation and public education without asking low- and middle-income families to pay a penny more. Now, before the vote, a few supporters and opponents made their cases on the floor of the House. Here's State Senator Jason Lewis, a Democrat from Winchester, arguing why this amendment should be put before the voters.
The reason why the Fair Share Amendment is so popular is that most people recognize that our wealthiest residents can afford to pay a bit more in taxes to help fund investments that expand opportunity and make our Commonwealth more just and more equitable for everyone.
So just how much money are we talking about here, Steve? And what is it going to be used for?
The supporters say that this should bring an extra $2 billion, give or take. Opponents doubt those figures, and they point to studies claiming that it would actually bring in less.
All right, so let's hear from the opponents then. What are they saying?
Yeah, they say that this could have negative and unintended consequences. Here's House Republican leader Brad Jones. He says the state shouldn't be changing the state constitution to write tax policy.
If we mess up on this, guess what? 4-year process. So if any of the bad things, some, all, or more of the bad things that some of us have concerns about happen, it's a 4-year process to fix.
So, Steve, why is it a 4-year process to fix? Is it because it's a constitutional amendment that they're proposing?
That's right. Because it's done in the Constitution as opposed to just a piece of legislation, there's this process. The legislature, two consecutive legislatures, has to okay it, and then twice, and then it goes before the voters. So it's a 3 to 4 year process from start to finish. And that's cumbersome. It was intended that way because they didn't want the Constitution being changed all the time. So they made it a little bit trickier. But in order to do this, to tax one group of people at a higher rate than another, that violates the state constitution in and of itself, because the state constitution says that we must have a flat tax. Everybody must be taxed the same. So they have to do it this way. In order to allow it to do it. Now, what Brad Jones had been telling me yesterday and today was that okay, you can say you can have a graduated income tax, but then let the legislature set that tax rate in ordinary legislation that if you pass it and then a year later you go, oh, gee, this wasn't a good idea, you can go back and you can change it. You can repeal it. You don't have to wait through that whole process.
And we're talking, again, years here. And this was supposed to be on the ballot in 2018. So just briefly here, Steve, what happened?
Well, Jamie, stop me if I get too wonky in this answer, but I'll try to make it simple.
We're all about the wonk here on Radio Boston.
Yeah, the amendment was moving forward back in 2018. That amendment originated as a citizen's ballot initiative. Supporters had gathered signatures to, in essence, force the legislature to take up the matter, which they did. Now, the Supreme Judicial Court ruled that a constitutional amendment that is started that way by a signature drive cannot combine unrelated subjects. And the court found that education and transportation were mutually dependent, so therefore the whole thing was unconstitutional. Now, a constitutional amendment that emanates from the legislature can combine more than one subject. Now, this amendment came in the form of a bill filed by legislators, so it should be good to go. Now I'm going to take off my wonk hat.
All right, so might be bulletproof. We'll see. Steve Brown, stick around because I want to bring in another voice here for some analysis. Evan Horowitz, he's the executive director of the Center for State Policy Analysis at Tufts University. Evan, always good to have you on the show. Welcome.
Jamie, it's great to be here. Though it makes me nervous that Steve's taking his wonk hat off. I feel like...
Well, it's so you could put it on because you're a numbers guy. So I do want to talk numbers. Look, I certainly don't make anywhere near $1 million, nor does anybody that I know. So who exactly would something like this impact?
So we are talking about a very, very small number of taxpayers, right? Something like 20,000 tax filers in Massachusetts who earn $1 million a year. And that is what we're talking about, not people who have $1 million in their bank accounts or in the value of their homes, people whose income amounts to $1 million in a given year. So yeah, 20,000 filers, that's about 0.6% of all tax filers in the state.
So a small number of folks, but potentially high revenues, right? I mean, Steve was talking about the sort of $2 billion estimate that supporters are citing. Does that number sound okay to you, reasonable?
I mean, it's in the ballpark. I think, you know, the estimates you'll hear are somewhere between $1.5 billion, $2 billion. And, you know, it'll end up, I think, in that range, though we'll do more work to try to pin that down. And Department of Revenue will do an official assessment before we get to the actual ballot date. I mean, this is a long process. We're here in June of 2021. It won't be put before voters until November of 2022.
And so your center is also going to do an independent analysis of the numbers. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. Likely in the fall. And, you know, a lot's going to happen between now and then. I mean, you said, you know, a small number of people, but a large amount of potential revenue, you know, $1.5, $2 billion, whatever it is a large amount of revenue. The other way to look at it is small group of filers, also some very wealthy, very powerful filers. So you're going to hear a lot from those people and the interest groups that, you know, stand for them.
Well, you'll hear a lot from them, but I'm also thinking, you know, the future of work, especially for folks at this income level, might look different. You know, working from home, maybe from Florida or New Hampshire, might, or moving. I mean, is that something that could impact the revenue that could come from this tax?
Yeah, I think for sure. I mean, this is obviously was near the top of nobody's list for likely impact of COVID, but you know, when the millionaire's tax was proposed and advanced beforehand in 2017 and 2018, those concerns that people, wealthy people in Massachusetts might move out of state seemed pretty overblown. There is a decent amount of research suggesting that it didn't really happen that much in states that raised their marginal income tax on high earners. There was some movement, but not enough really to offset a lot of the revenue. But the world's really changed. And with the growth of remote and hybrid work, it is going to get easier for people to live in one place and work in another. And it's possible that that research just doesn't apply anymore. And a new tax bracket like this, it's not called the bracket, but like a new surtax on millionaires could have a bigger effect on people's decision about where to settle than was previously thought.
And Steve Brown, you know, I mentioned New Hampshire there, but because there is this ongoing battle right now between the states about income tax collected for folks who are working from home in New Hampshire but work for Massachusetts companies. So are the supporters of this thinking about the impact of folks leaving the state?
Yeah, I mean, the supporters are saying that the argument that people are going to leave is a little overblown, that, you know, the reason why people are here in Massachusetts is the economy is good, their business is good, this is where it's happening, and so they would want to pick up and leave because of that. They're saying that that just doesn't have that merit that people, you know, some people will leave. Of course they will, but you know, will they be leaving in by the bus loads or the limousine loads or however they leave?
Private jet loads.
Supporters of this say that is not going to happen. That's overblown.
Of course, Evan Horwitz, I'm also thinking about sort of the reporting from ProPublica this week about how little taxes really the sort of top 0.1% of Americans actually pay, something like a true tax rate of just over 3% compared to the average American taxpayer who pays about 14% by comparison. I guess my question here is, you know, by raising the income tax on highest earners, are we kind of missing the point here? We're not actually taxing their wealth. We're just taxing their income.
Yeah. So I'll say first, I wasn't convinced that the phrase true tax rate made any sense, but it's certainly true that for wealthy Americans, it's possible to kind of hold stocks and see the value of those stocks go up, and therefore to have a lot more money at the end of the year than you had at the beginning of the year, and yet not to be taxed on that increase. It doesn't really count as taxable income. And the millionaire's tax is not going to change that. It's not going to tax that kind of income. If you don't sell your stocks, but they get more valuable, you have more money, but you are not taxed on that additional. So that's not going to affect that. But in some ways, that was never the idea behind it. It wasn't about equalizing tax rates across groups. It was a way of saying, Massachusetts has needs, right? We have policy needs, investments in education, K-12, early ed, higher ed, investments in transportation. And, you know, when you want to make these investments, you need to raise revenue for it. And the state, like the entire country, has seen a huge increase in inequality over the last generation. So it made sense to say, look, the people who have benefited the most should contribute to make the necessary investments for the state. So I think that was always kind of the rationale for it, as opposed to some effort to kind of balance tax rates across income groups.
So that's sort of what's at stake there. WBUR Steve Brown, you know, we saw a huge ballot campaign in 2018, I believe, with the charter school question. Are we going to be seeing this kind of hot campaign this time around?
Oh, yes, absolutely. We have a year and a half to work ourselves into a frenzy over this upcoming ballot initiative or ballot question that will be coming up, the constitutional amendment. Expect to see the opponents who have a lot of money to afford a significant public relations campaign. That can buy a lot of vote no signs and a lot of vote no ads that will be coming to your internet and TV and everywhere else that you look. So expect to be bombarded as we get closer. I'm sure the supporters will be doing that as well. But do they have the funds to really keep up with the opponents? That remains to be seen.
All right. Well, we'll stay tuned here at WBUR. That's Steve Brown, WBUR senior statehouse reporter. Steve, thank you.
Thank you, Jamie.
And Evan Horwitz, he's the executive director of the Center for State Policy Analysis at Tufts University. Evan, always great to have you as well.
Thanks, Jamie. I'll leave my wonk hat here on the way out.
All right, I'll wear it for the next segment. There is a battle going on within the state's Republican Party. Let me just set this up for you, because last week, according to emails obtained by the Boston Globe, state GOP committeewoman Deborah Martell made homophobic remarks against a fellow Republican, congressional candidate Jeffrey Sosa Paquette. Sosa Paquette is gay, married, and the adoptive father of two. And Martell's comments that she's sickened that he and his husband adopted children resulted in a wave of legislators condemning her and calling for her resignation. Governor Charlie Baker, the state party's biggest name, weighed in.
Those were bigoted remarks. There's simply no way around that. Anyone who's a serious member of the party organization should be denouncing them.
One voice was, until recently, notably silent, committee chairman Jim Lyons. He eventually called Martell's remarks offensive, but has refused to call for her resignation, dismissing the movement against her as, quote, cancel culture. Now, 29 out of 30 Republicans in the House are calling for Lyons to resign his post. So let's turn to one of those 29, State Representative Sean Dooley. Representative Dooley, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hey, thank you so much for having me back.
So what's going on here? Is this actually an example of cancel culture, or should Martell step aside?
No, as I say, I don't believe it's a cancel culture by any stretch of the imagination. I think, unfortunately, it's a absence of leadership is really the dominant issue that we should be talking about. Is that Jim Lyons had the opportunity, you know, when someone you know, especially one of his supporters and one of his state committee people said something that was bigoted and hateful. And repeatedly, by the way, it wasn't just one incident. It was a series of incidences. He had the opportunity to take the narrative and say, hey, listen, this is not who we are. This is not what we stand for. Let me tell you what Republicans really believe in. And instead, he made excuses for her and covered for her and said, oh, well, I'm not going to get involved. And then 5 days later, he changed his tune. He's like, well, I'm supporting her First Amendment right. That's I think, where the big issue is that there are people that are within our party that are willing to say this is sort of thing is okay.
So you don't buy his argument that it's an issue of free speech or that, you know, the party needs to be inclusive of people of deep faith?
No, we 100% need to be inclusive of people of, you know, deep faith. And the First Amendment, let's just back up from a civics lesson standpoint. The First Amendment is about the government imposing regulations on you and the government putting you in jail. No one is talking about doing that. But if you work for IBM or if you work for McDonald's and you greet a customer and you use a racial slur or you say something anti-Semitic or things along those lines, that may be your right. You may not go to jail, but you will not still have a job. That's the reality. Deb Martell is a state committee woman from Ludlow, and she represents that Senate area. And basically, in her position, she tried to get him, you know, not allowed to speak at a meeting because he's gay. She said, we need to find someone to primary him on the ballot so we can knock him off the ballot because he's gay. You know, there was a series of things. That's a completely different story than a pure free speech.
So do you think...
Go ahead.
Sorry, we're short on time today. So do you think Lyons should step aside? I do want to note, of course, you ran against him to lead the party. You came 3 votes short of unseating him. But do you think he should step aside because of this?
I mean, I don't want to say that just from the standpoint that I ran against him. I wish he would step up. If he's not going to step aside, I wish he would step up and actually lead. Take some stances, actually step forth and talk to the press. And help the party grow, help the people understand that this is not who we are. If he's unwilling to do that, then yes, I think he should step aside.
So the state party isn't big, right? I mean, lost seats in the last election, does hold the corner office. In your view, it sounds like you're saying that there is room for an openly gay congressional candidate in this GOP, even though the messaging doesn't seem to support that.
Well, I think unfortunately what we have is we have a few bigots with some very loud voices, and in the past we haven't been willing to condemn them, and I think that's one of our mistakes. We need to, you know, we can't just say we're not racist and we can't just say we're not bigots. We have to be anti-racist. We have to be anti-bigot. We need to go out there and throw punches and make statements like this. If you're going to be this, you do not represent us, and you should step down. And that's the reason I was really proud of our entire, all but one person, Mark Lombardo from Bill Ricca. I was really proud of our delegation that we all stood up and made that stand.
So, you know, you have a governor who's a Republican, who is one of the most popular governors in the country, right? And I'm just wondering how you hope this all shakes out and where this takes the party next.
What I hope is this, you know, and this was, I filed a resolution, you know, condemning hate, condemning bigotry. And I wanted to make sure that we were able to get that word out there, that this isn't who we are. We're not going to let a few define most of us. We're the party of Lincoln. We started by fighting racial injustice. We should continue that along those paths.
And that's State Representative Sean Dooley. State Representative Dooley, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. Anytime.
And listening into that conversation is WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks, who's been following this story closely. So let's bring him back in. Hey, Anthony.
Hey, Jamie. Nice to be with you.
Thanks for joining us. So just give us your initial reactions to what you heard there from Representative Sean Dooley.
Well, it's interesting because I guess I was thinking that in a lot of ways, what's playing out here in Massachusetts among Republicans is playing out across the country. You know, in many state Republican parties, fealty to Trump or sort of Trump-style politics has become a kind of litmus test. And Jim Lyons, the party chairman, represents that wing of the party. And so, as you heard, Sean Dooley, more moderate, would like to pull back from that kind of aggressive, hyper-partisan posture. And so really what you're seeing here is a fight for the future, for the soul of the state GOP. You know, will it be continued to be fashioned by people like Jim Lyons and his supporters? Or can the state's most popular Republican, Charlie Baker, who didn't support Trump, define the party, which is really struggling for relevance in many ways once you get beyond Charlie Baker?
Yeah, I mean, just the idea that 29 out of 30 of the elected folks in the legislature signed onto this letter calling for you know, Martell to step aside, Jim Lyons to do something about it. Is support for Lyons waning?
You know, it's maybe. I mean, I think it's fair. Here's what I know I can say. Jim Lyons represents the hard right, the Trump wing of the Republican Party in Massachusetts. And don't forget that more than a million folks in this state voted for Trump. So Lyons has supporters. But I also think it's fair to say that this has been a tough period for him. I mean, the state GOP got hammered in the last election. They didn't pick up a single congressional seat. Democrats have supermajorities in the state legislature. For example, Republicans have only three out of 40 seats in the Senate. And now, as he continues to sort of pick a fight with Charlie Baker, which seems bizarre, the hugely popular governor, and with his refusal to condemn Deborah Martell for those controversial remarks, a lot of folks think he went too far, including Tom Mountain. So here's Tom Mountain. He's the vice chair of the state GOP.
You know, what she did was heinous. It was intolerant. And quite frankly, it makes the rest of the party look bad. And the chairman initially stayed out of it, and then he doubled down to back her.
So you can hear Mountain's concern about Lyons there. And I'm hearing from a number of senior Republicans, including folks high up in the state party, that it's time for Lyons to go. But again, keep in mind, he defeated Sean Dooley just a few months ago for the chairmanship of the party.
Right, right. And I should note that we did reach out to Jim Lyons today. We have not yet heard back. But how would you characterize his approach moving forward after the 2020 election loss? You mentioned, of course, the White House, but also here in Massachusetts. What's his approach to sort of energizing that base of Republican voters here in Massachusetts?
Well, you know, Chairman Lyons is unapologetic about his embrace of former President Trump. And by the way, Jamie, I reached out to him yesterday because I wanted to talk to him about all of this brouhaha within the party. He didn't get back to me. But his approach now, since the 2020 election loss, his position is that Trump essentially energizes Republican voters. Here's what he told me last January.
I am very optimistic that President Trump has brought a groundswell of people who were uninvolved to get involved. So I'm very, I'm kind of like Newt Gingrich. I'm a happy warrior.
So there you can hear it. You know, his approach is to basically double down his support of Donald Trump. And that's really the kind of Republican vision that he represents in the state right now.
Now, we've touched on this a little bit, but the sort of strained relationship with Governor Baker, as I mentioned, one of the most popular governors in the country, but sort of at loggerheads with Lyons and these efforts to really oust Baker from the party's leadership. What's the thinking here? Why isn't the party sort of leaning on Baker as a power broker?
Well, I mean, I think a lot of people in the party are. I mean, what's interesting about Baker is that he's figured out how to run and govern in a state in which Republicans are heavily outnumbered by Democrats. You know, and Baker has done such a good job threading that needle that he's actually more popular with Democrats than he is with members of his own party. That said, a number of moderate Republicans also support him, and for good reason. You know, he knows how to win. He raises a ton of money. So here's Jane Swift. She's the former governor of Massachusetts. She told me earlier this year that she asked the same question that you're asking. She doesn't understand why Republicans like Lyons and his backers are not embracing Baker.
They should be courting Charlie Baker. They should send him flowers. They should see how he likes his coffee and make sure that they hand deliver it to him.
So Jamie Swift said, you know, it's shocking that a party that is almost irrelevant, these are her words, yeah, has an asset like Charlie Baker would be almost at war with the most important attribute they have.
Anthony, 30-second answer here because we do have a hard clock. Where do you see this version of the Massachusetts GOP going?
Well, it's clearly, you know, the current course of the state GOP is not a recipe for success. You know, as one Republican said to me, we're fighting an uphill battle as it is. Now the party represents less than 10% of the electorate. It's strapped for cash. It's at war with its popular governor. It doesn't seem like this is a way forward and to grow the party.
Well, we'll see also if the governor chooses to run for another term. That is WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks. Anthony, it is always great to talk to you. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, Jamie. Thank you.
You're going to want to set the alarm on your phone for a little earlier than usual tomorrow, 5:08 a.m. to be precise, because that's the exact moment when the sun will rise in our fair city and our burning gaseous star will align with the earth and the moon for an annular eclipse. And to help us safely look at the skies, let's catch up with Kelly Beatty. He's senior editor of Cambridge-based Sky and Telescope magazine, on his way out of town to chase the eclipse. And Kelly, for us still here in Boston, what will this so-called Ring of Fire eclipse look like tomorrow?
The Earth, Moon, and Sun will line up in such a way that the Moon goes directly across the Sun. But because the Moon's a little farther away than usual, it won't completely cover the Sun and will literally leave a ring of sun in the sky. And that is called an annular eclipse. And you are not going to see that in Boston, I'm afraid. The path for that is southern Canada, Greenland, the North Pole, and Siberia. So maybe we can all catch a flight. In Boston, what's going to happen is that the alignment won't be that perfect. And so we'll see a deep partial eclipse of the sun, where the moon kind of goes over the sun, but not quite, covering about 80% of it just a little bit after sunrise.
Kelly, you said catch a flight, and that's exactly what you're doing, right?
Oh, I am. I'm actually in O'Hare in Chicago on my way to Minneapolis. This path through Canada is pretty remote place. And of course, the border with Canada is still locked down. So we Sky and Telescope, based in Cambridge, have chartered a Delta plane leaving Minneapolis. We have about 35 people on board. We're going to fly off into the night over southern Canada, take a left turn as we get north of Lake Superior. And we're going to watch the annular eclipse, the ring eclipse, from 38,000 feet. And then we're going to fly back to Minneapolis and have breakfast.
Okay, so for you, what will it look like?
We'll be catching it at its geometric best. The Earth, Moon, and Sun will align. The Moon will move directly over the center of the Sun. It'll be a few degrees above the horizon, which will make it that much more dramatic. And the Moon will be perfectly centered in the Sun, so it'll be this thin ring of sun remaining in the sky, and then a few minutes later it'll move off and the eclipse will begin to wane.
And then you'll land back on ground. Of course, I'm also reminded of the viewing safety, so I do want to just pull back for a second here to remind folks that it's never safe to look directly at the sun. So how should we here in Boston stay safe while looking at it tomorrow morning?
Right. You set the stage, right? So the eclipse will be well underway when sunrise occurs at about 5:07, 5:08 in the morning. And so if you can get anywhere that has a clear view to the northeast, I'm talking perfectly flat, you will see literally coming up from the horizon a shark fin shaped bit of sun, a horn, if you will, indicating that the eclipse is well underway. And as the sun rises, the eclipse will actually get a little bit deeper and deeper and peaks at about 5:33. Now, a lot of the sun is still showing, so you want to view it safely. And that means just don't look at it directly. There are a couple of ways you can do it. If, for example, you've got eclipse glasses left over from 2017, that would be a great way to do it. If, as long as they're not, like, you know, got holes in them or something, they'll be safe to use. Most people won't have that. And so a couple of things I would suggest are, let the sun shine through your crossed fingers against a wall and crisscross like a waffle pattern. And you'll see little crescent suns from the holes.
Like hold up your fingers like you're making a makeshift screen?
Yes, exactly. Or use a colander or a straw hat with little holes in it and let little bits of sun shine through against a plain surface like a wall, and you will see little crescents on the wall where each of those little dabs of sunlight land. That is an absolutely safe way to do it.
You know, you mentioned 2017, and Kelly, I remember gathering here at WBUR with our entire staff on the roof of our building. We were wearing those special glasses, and some of us were holding those shoe boxes up to our eyes and looking at the total solar eclipse back then. How will this one, an annular eclipse, for those of us who might not understand the difference, how will they differ?
Well, so first of all, in Boston, what you saw was a partial just like this one.
Okay.
And I think the sort of depth of the bite out of the sun will be pretty comparable. So if you remember what it looked like then, you're going to have a repeat, except it'll happen at sunrise. It's amazing. The difference between total and annular, you know, geometrically, they're the same. But when the moon completely covers the sun, then there is no sun left in the sky. The sky gets dark. So you're left with a black spot, like a bullet hole in the sky, surrounded by this ethereal, wispy, iridescent cloud, the corona, which is Spanish for crown, that is electric in its brightness. It's just astounding. That represents the superheated atmosphere of the sun, a couple of million degrees, giving off its own light and reflected light. And the only time you can see that corona is during a total solar eclipse. Unfortunately for Boston, that will not be the case tomorrow morning.
Kelly, just hearing you talk about this in the way that you do, it's very clear to me that you are an umbrophile, if I could put it that way. Is that safe to say?
Absolutely. You know, there's a group of maybe 500 or 1,000 people worldwide who will go to any length to see one of these solar eclipses. And so our flight gives very literal meaning to the term eclipse chaser, because that's exactly what we're doing. We're chasing it down over the skies of southern Canada.
I'm still thinking about this idea that so much has changed in the past year about the way we experience so many different things, communal experiences. And I do remember back so fondly to that 2017 eclipse. And I'm just wondering what's lost when we don't have these communal viewing moments of things like this.
Well, I have to say, you know, the pandemic has been very good for amateur astronomy. People were stuck at home, often with their families and kids in tow and such, and they were looking for things to do. And it turns out that telescopes were flying out of stores. So much so that because a lot of them are made in China right now, and the supply chain from China was kind of constricted, a lot of places that sell telescopes ran out. So right now we have this good moment where a lot of people are discovering the sky maybe for the first time, or rediscovering what they remember from their youth. And as far as I'm concerned, that's all good.
Yeah, you know, when I think about most of the time, we're just good little worker ants keeping our heads down here on Earth. But then every once in a while, from time to time, we get these celestial moments that remind us to look up and pause and reflect. And I'm just wondering from you what you think it is about moments like this that fascinate us on such a basic, universal, human level.
They fascinate me because this is what my whole life is wound up around. Like last year, some people remember maybe a superly close conjunction between the planets Jupiter and Saturn in the sky. They were so close together, hadn't happened that way for centuries. And then these eclipses are another kind of cycle of the solar system. The sun, moon, and Earth align and go their separate ways and then align again, whether we're here on Earth or not. I think it's special that we're in a place where we can enjoy this. There aren't any other planets that we know of in the solar system that, or anywhere for that matter, that have this kind of special geometry. Total solar eclipses in our solar system can only happen on Earth.
You just gave me chills there. Thank you. That's Kelly Beatty, senior editor of Sky and Telescope magazine, joining us from O'Hare Airport. Kelly, thank you so much.
A pleasure.
And again, don't look directly at the sun. If you use a colander or something to see the partial eclipse of the sun, turn around and look at its reflection on a wall or some other surface. We've got more information on how to view tomorrow's eclipse safely at our website, radioboston.org. All this week, we're bringing you some of our favorite book conversations. Now that the days are longer and hotter, it's the perfect time to snuggle up with a good book. Last night, we heard from Pulitzer Prize-winning author Richard Russo about his novel, which tells the story of male friendship.
In this book, with these three characters, I'm kind of assuming the wisdom of what Walt Whitman said when he said, "I'm large, I contain multitudes." I think what I've done in this book is to take these three friends and kind of divided my own personality.
Tonight, we revisit a conversation between host Tiziana Dearing and Mendon author Michael Togas about his memoir, The Waters Between Us, which tells the story of his life and his family. Now, normally when we speak to Togus on this show, it's usually about his latest best-selling book of heroism and rescue at sea, whether it was Finest Hours, which was made into a Disney movie, or 10 Hours Until Dawn off the coast of Salem in the blizzard of 78, or So Close to Home about surviving a German U-boat attack. But his latest book is still full of adventure, danger, and heroism and sacrifice. But instead of historical figures, the characters are people in Togus' own life. When Togus spoke to us about The Waters Between Us, he began by sharing why he turned the searchlight from sea heroes to his real-life hero, his father.
My dad was one of those larger-than-life figures. As soon as somebody saw him, they'd be smiling, and he would just light up a room. And I'd been taking notes for this book, you know, going way back in my 20s about some of the misadventures, like when I almost died in that $15 raft I bought going down a river in April. I had different sources to draw on besides just the memories. I had a diary from when I was 12 years old, starting to put it together. And after he passed away, then you can go back even further and some of those events from your really young years come back.
So the book has a subtitle, A Boy, A Father, Outdoor Misadventures and the Healing Power of Nature. And these misadventures, you just talked about a story you tell of going down some water you should not have been in a $15 raft with a friend. And there are so many times where I found myself thinking, this guy's instinct for self-preservation was underdeveloped. Are you that same guy, or did telling these stories bring a piece of you back as well? And if you are that same guy, how are you still alive?
There's a lot of luck. When you're impulsive, as I was, there's luck involved. I never had anybody expertizing. Like, my father was not a big outdoorsman, and so he wasn't saying, you know, when I was a boy, the fish were this big, or here's how you attack a mountain when you're going to climb it. So everything I did was by trial and error. And looking back, I think in many ways that's a good thing, because it taught me independence, but it also taught me, no matter what the situation, I'll somehow figure it out, because he wasn't there for those kind of things.
He wasn't there until he was.
You know what? I said those exact words last night to a friend who was asking me about the book. I said, you know, he never came to my wrestling matches, my soccer games, but a little later when I was struggling and dropped out of college, he had my back, and he really surprised me. I did not expect that.
You know, I got an understanding through across your family and through the emergence of your father in the book. He's kind of a quiet background character till close to the end. Mm. That his sense was, and your sense was, that crisis is when it really matters. And he was there for all of you in crisis. What have you learned from that about what it means to show up?
You know, the beauty of the way he reacted, and we'll talk a little bit about the big tragedy in the family, yeah, was he chose how to respond. That's what I learned from him. He could have become bitter, angry, withdrawn, but he said, no, I'm going to do this, and life is going to go on. And he was still that fun-loving guy, despite the new burdens that were put upon him. And that's what he taught me.
So let's talk about that burden, the crisis. There's a bombshell in maybe the last fifth of the book. And let's just have you read that bombshell for our listeners. It's right at the start of chapter 17.
Okay. The fun days of college came to a screeching halt in February 1976. That's when I got the phone call. I was in my dorm room when a friend knocked on my door and told me my mom was on the payphone. I had a bad feeling from the get-go, because my parents never called me, knowing I was impossible to reach and that I would call them once a month. I can still see that payphone in the hallway of the dorm and remember how I stood there stock still, listening to my mother. She told me my sister Lynn and her newlywed husband had been in a car accident. She said it was bad. Then there was silence. Finally, I asked how bad, and she said Len's in a coma. I could hear my mother softly crying. I asked where my father was, and she said he was by Len's side. I better come home, I finally said. My mother caught her breath and said yes, but I should finish up my classes for the week and get home on the weekend. She said the most important thing I could do was pray, and pray I did.
That's author Michael Togas reading from his new memoir, The Waters Between Us. Of course, what stands out there to me is you ask where your father is, and she says he's by Lynn's side, which, of course, that's where he then was permanently. Talk about what happened next and the sacrifices that your father made.
Well, that accident left Len paralyzed and severely brain damaged. And after months in a rehab center, there were still tubes and everything else attached to her. And my father just said, we're taking her home. And the doctor said, no, you won't be able to do this. And he said, teach us what we have to do. We're taking her home. And for the next 30 some odd years, he and my mother took care of her at home. And it's hard to describe. I get a little emotional even now. But it was a 24/7 job. It's not like you could get a good night's sleep. You were up during the night helping her. And every once in a blue moon, I'd step in so they could get a night away. And just in a 24-hour period, I thought I'd lose my mind. It was so difficult to do. And I just marveled that they did this for so many years. And my father would say, it's an honor to take care of Lynn. It's no burden at all. But it was just this amazing devotion.
And that's what you meant when you said earlier about the choices that he made, right?
Exactly. You know, this was the biggie, and he decided, we're going to do this. We're going to keep Lynn as part of the family. We'd get her in a wheelchair. I'd often help him. And even though she couldn't eat with us, she'd be at the dinner table with us. So, and again, he never became bitter. You know, he was such a social animal. He just said to all his friends, you come to me. And they would come to the house all the time. I think it drove my mother nuts. But he never changed. He'd be laughing with them at the house while he was taking care of Lynn. And it was just jaw-dropping to me to see how he pulled it all off.
You know, your mom did hold it all together, right? I'm sure it did drive her nuts some of the time. I wonder, as a mother, how it wouldn't. Sometimes I pictured her, as I was reading your story, as a woman sort of standing firmly in the center of a hurricane. Tell us a little bit about her and how she fits in the story you're now telling yourself about yourself.
She was very reserved and very quiet, but every once in a blue moon, she'd surprise me. And one example I give in The Waters Between Us is I've organized senior skip day at high school. And by this time, I've turned my life around in terms of grades at school. Prior to then, I had broken the school record for detention. Because I organized a senior skip day, the principal was going to expel me because every senior skipped school. And I had to tell my mother. I didn't dare tell my father. And she goes, I'm heading down there. And I said, where? She goes, to that principal. And I couldn't believe it, because this was a woman who didn't say peep. And somehow she got me out of that jam. And so underneath her, kind of what I earlier thought was kind of a timid person, she had this rock solid strength. And she was there with my father during Lynn's accident, and deserves as much credit as him.
So I think about comparing your mother and your father, who were real people, but also, for me, characters, right? Because I'm reading this memoir, and all of the daring sea rescuers and sea rescuers in the other books of yours that I've read. Where do you put your mom and dad in the pantheon of these heroes that you write about?
The heroes I've written about the past, it's usually one and done. In other words, The Finest Hours, Bernie Weber does that rescue, but it happened in one evening. Ernie Hazard and Fatal Forecast, he survives 3 days in the North Atlantic. You know, he's off the charts of survivability. But you have to also acknowledge these people that get up day in and day out and do something extraordinary and don't want any credit, don't want any attention. So I put what my mom and dad did right at the top of that list, because to sustain it and not crack or not become bitter and withdrawn is a real feat.
You know, it's almost second nature at this point, a year into this pandemic, to just ask what the lessons for us are. But it doesn't have to be second nature here, because I believe there are so many lessons in this memoir that have something to say about the moment that we're in. Is there one that you would draw out for us a year into this pandemic?
It's that endurance of going, I'm going to get through this. I'm going to make the best out of this situation. I'm not going to let it affect, and I'm talking as my father's mind, the rest of my family. Because it wasn't like, as he's helping Len, he's giving short change to the three boys. The same with this pandemic. A couple times during it, I'd feel myself getting depressed in isolation. And I'd go, screw that, make yourself productive. And I'd do whatever the task was. And then I'd go out and take a long walk. And I would think of my father during this going, this would have been, he used to have a little expression when I talk about a problem, he'd pretend there'd be a piece of lint on his shoulder and he'd just flick it off. And he'd go, that's what I think about that. That's small potatoes. He probably would not be happy with this book, because he would say to me, I don't want you writing about me. There's plenty of other people that have done things just like your mom and I. But I felt, how could I leave this out of my story?
That was Mendon author Michael Togas speaking with host Tiziana Deering in March about his memoir and latest book, The Waters Between Us. That's our show for today. Thanks for listening. Radio Boston is produced by Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, Walter Wuthman. Radio Boston is produced by Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Wuthman, with help from Stephen Gelman and Hafsa Qureshi. Our engineer is Marquise Neal, and our executive producer is Satesh Hathi. I'm Jamie Bologna. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.